welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 41, the history of canoes and canoodling on the Charles River. Hi, I'm Jake. And co-host Nikki is out of town, so you're stuck with me. This week, I'm going to talk about the late 19th century canoe craze, when recreational canoeing became Boston's hottest leisure time activity. We'll also discuss how young lovers took advantage of the privacy and intimacy of a canoe to engage in a little bit of illicit romance, and how a humorless state police agency came to ban kissing in canoes on the Charles River. But before we talk about kissing in canoes, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history. Monday is August 14th, which marks the 252nd anniversary of one of the first acts of colonial resistance against Crown rule. Boston's first protest against the Stamp Act was held on August 14, 1765. The Stamp Act required that paper used in the colonies for everything from newspapers to playing cards had to carry an embossed stamp. The stamp would be affixed in London, indicating that a special tax had been paid. That tax was widely resented in the colonies, especially in Massachusetts. Since the tax was levied by Parliament, and the colonists couldn't vote, they adopted the motto, "No taxation without representation." After the tax went into effect in the spring of 1765, the Sons of Liberty began organizing resistance to it and coordinating with other colonies. On the night of August 14th, a large crowd gathered around an elm tree along Boston's Orange Street. An effigy of the tax collector Andrew Oliver was hung from this tree with the inscription, "Fair freedom's glorious cause I meanly quitted, betrayed my country for the sake of pelf. But ah, at length the devil hath me outwitted. Instead of stamping others, have hanged myself. What greater joy did ever New England see than a stamp man hanging on a tree?" Mass protests followed for the next 2 weeks, escalating into riots on many nights. On the 17th, Oliver was compelled to resign while standing under that same elm tree, which had come to be known as the Liberty Tree. The Stamp Act would be repealed in 1766, but it was replaced with other taxes, including one on tea. And we all know how that turned out. On August 15, 1919, the Boston Police Department voted to form a union. The starting salary for a police officer had been frozen for 62 years, and runaway inflation meant that their wages had less earning power than ever. Police officers had to buy their own uniforms and gear, which could add up to almost 15% of their annual salary. By 1919, they made less in a day than an unskilled steelworker, less than a streetcar conductor, and half as much as a carpenter or a mechanic. Despite opposition from Governor Calvin Coolidge, who at the time appointed the police commissioner rather than the mayor doing so, the officers got a charter from the moderate American Federation of Labor. On August 15th, over 1,000 policemen gathered in a hall in the South End. After hearing arguments from all sides, they voted overwhelmingly to unionize. The police commissioner issued an order forbidding any officer from joining the union, saying, "He must fail either in his duty as a policeman or in his obligation to the organization that controls him." 3 weeks later, the union called a strike, and the Boston Police Department walked off the job. 3 days of looting and chaos followed, forcing Governor Coolidge to call in the National Guard to restore order. You can hear the full story of the 1919 Boston police strike in episode 28. Wednesday is August 16th, and on August 16th, 1774, John Adams was making his way to Philadelphia to attend the First Continental Congress. He wrote in his diary to describe the experience as his party approached New Haven, Connecticut. 7 miles out of town at a tavern, we met a great number of carriages and of horsemen who had come out to meet us. The sheriff of the county and the constable of the town and the justices of the peace were in the train. As we were coming, we met others, to the amount of, I know not what number, but a very great one. As we came into the town, all the bells in town were set to ringing, and the people, men, women, and children, were crowding the doors and windows as if it was to see a coronation. At 9 o'clock, the cannon were fired, about a dozen guns, I think. These expressions of respect to us are intended as demonstrations of the sympathy of this people with the Massachusetts Bay and its capital, and to show their expectations from the Congress and their determination to carry into execution whatever shall be agreed on. The delegates enjoyed widespread support in the face of the intolerable acts passed by the Parliament to punish the colonies after the Boston Tea Party. In response, Congress passed a resolve in favor of a continent-wide boycott of British goods. The following year, a second Continental Congress would meet. During their session, war broke out, and they would declare independence. Following the Columbine Massacre in April 1999, Massachusetts Governor Paul Salucci's administration released a youth violence reduction program on August 17th, focusing on education, prevention, critical incident management, and safe schools legislation. The introduction provides a little bit of context behind the hysteria that the youth of today are out of control, and things were better in the good old days. The issue of the behavior of young people is not a new concern. Tablets recovered from before 2000 BC describe the problems that society faced with its misbehaving youth. In his annual reports to the Commonwealth, Horace Mann cited the criminal behavior of young people to bolster his argument for the common school in the mid-1800s. For more than 20 years, surveys of the American public show that discipline and student behavior are the public's top concerns with their schools. Combating violence in the public schools is a recurring focus of families, educators, business, religious, and community leaders, as well as local and state policymakers across the country. Friday is August 18th. An anonymous letter printed on the front page of the Boston Gazette on August 18th, 1766, celebrated the recent repeal of the Stamp Act as a victory for English liberty. I should think the following doctrines more worthy of British American creed: that George III, whom God preserve, is and can be king, but of a free people; that this title is his chief glory, and from this he receives the greatest luster; that a free people, or English subjects, have rights; that whatever pretenses a people may make to freedom, if they dare not assert, support, and if need be defend their rights, they are not free; that whenever it is dangerous for a free people to assert their rights, it is sure sign that the rights themselves are in danger; that the most open and bold assertions of them can never justly offend anyone; and therefore, that it is no crime, but rather our indispensable duty at all times to assert them. Seems a fitting reminder for an era in which our rights themselves seem to be in danger. The USS Constitution earned her nickname Old Ironsides in a sea battle with the British frigate Guerrière on August 19, 1812. At 2 p.m., off the coast of Nova Scotia, lookouts on the Constitution spotted a sail. It turned out to be the Guerrière, one of the squadron of British ships that had relentlessly pursued the Constitution in a three-day chase the previous month. The two ships hoisted their colors, indicating a willingness to duel, and maneuvered closer. The British captain ordered his more experienced crew to begin firing broadsides early and from a distance. The American captain held his fire through 4 hours of maneuvering. Finally, he said, "Within less than a pistol shot, we commenced a very heavy fire from all of our guns." Less than 35 minutes after the Constitution began to fire, the British ship was in ruins. As her guns cut the Guerrière to shreds, one of the Constitution's sailors saw 18-pound cannonballs bouncing off her live oak hull. Astounded, he cried, "Huzzah! Her sides are made of iron!" The nickname stuck. Soon after, the British captain fired a gun to leeward, indicating a surrender, and struck his colors. In a letter to his commanding officers, he would say, "The Guerrière was so cut up that all attempts to get her in would have been useless. As soon as the wounded were got out of her, they set her afire, and I feel it my duty to state that the conduct of Captain Hull and his officers to our men has been that of a brave enemy." After a 2-year restoration and dry dock, Old Ironsides is now floating again. She is the oldest commissioned warship in the world. Finally, Sunday is August 20th. In the 1940s, the S.A. Woods Machine Company was a small manufacturing outfit in South Boston. It made woodworking machinery and induction motors, and starting in 1940, it made munitions for the U.S. and British militaries. After the outbreak of World War II, the company's efforts to manufacture ordnance increased, soon accounting for over 650 of 1,000 total employees. The workers were represented by United Electrical Workers Local 272, but during wartime, their collective bargaining rights were limited. Since they were considered defense workers, contract negotiations had to be carried out through the National War Labor Board. During the spring and summer of 1942, the company and union members couldn't agree on wage increases, and a federal mediator stepped in. The company refused to adhere to the compromise reached by the federal mediator, saying that requiring a company to enter into arbitration with a union was un-American. As promised raises weren't upheld, the union threatened strikes. Meanwhile, munitions contracts worth millions of dollars went unfilled. Finally, FDR had enough, signing an order to seize the plant in order to restore war production, as well as setting an example for other companies that defied the War Labor Board. His order said, "No company and no labor organization can be permitted to defy the mandate of this impartial tribunal with impunity." On August 20th, 1942, the U.S. Army marched through the factory gates with fixed bayonets. They seized the plant, company assets, and records. The Army would operate the factory for the remainder of the war, acting as an employer for the civilian workers. After a protracted legal battle, the factory was condemned and turned over to another company shortly before VJ Day made the entire issue moot. And now, from wartime disputes to peaceful pursuits. A 1903 tourist guide to Boston describes the experience of taking a trolley from Copley Square, out Commonwealth Avenue, to Newton. It gushes about the well-groomed road, the immaculate lawns and houses, and the swift and smooth operation of the trolley. Finally, it describes the objective of this day trip. "Our terminus is the favorite pleasure ground called Norumbega Park, where the trolley company has provided on the shore of the stream a variety of attractions for many tastes. An open-air theater, an extensive menagerie, a cafe, and a large boathouse where canoes and rowboats may be hired. A launch plies the river between the park and Waltham, making hourly trips daily, afternoon and evening. Canoeing is the all-engrossing sport on this part of the river, and just around the bend to our left is the Riverside Recreation Ground. We cannot see it, for a high wooded promontory shuts it off from our view. But we may take a canoe and paddle up through the stone arch of the Weston Bridge, and in a few minutes we shall be in the thick of the fleet at Riverside, where on a pleasant afternoon or evening the water is often so densely covered that one might almost cross the stream by stepping from one canoe to another. Frequently during the summer, the fleet parades, decorated with lanterns, bunting, and flowers. The grounds and boathouses are extensive and well-equipped, and nearby are the houses of the Newton Boat Club, the Boston Canoe Club, and the Boston Athletic Association, whose large membership helps to swell the crowds upon the river on these occasions." Canoeing didn't start out as a leisure activity. Long, narrow craft that taper at either end have been used by cultures around the world for millennia. One of the earliest examples was discovered along the Euphrates River Valley and dated to 4000 BCE. Canoes were used by Native Americans as a highly practical way to navigate the rivers, lakes, and nearshore waters across North America. And after European contact, they continued to be the most efficient way to move people and goods on many waterways, especially in Canada. The French fur trade became so tightly entwined with the use of canoes that the word voyageur was coined, to refer specifically to the men who made their living through hauling furs by canoe. Recreational canoeing was born in the mid-19th century, and though canoes were mainly identified with North America, the rise in recreational canoeing was a British phenomenon. In 1858, a Scottish author named John McGregor went on vacation, camping in Canada and in the northern U.S. On this trip, he was introduced to canoes, which his guides used to get him and his gear to remote sites in the wilderness. McGregor was hooked. After he returned to the U.K., he began building his own canoes and paddling them on the rivers and canals around Britain and around Europe. Under the pseudonym Rob Roy, he published the 1866 book, A Thousand Miles in the Rob Roy Canoe on the Rivers and Lakes of Europe, and he founded a canoe club later that year. A canoe craze swept Britain in the 1870s, with clubs and competitions springing up around the country. In the following decade, the craze made it back to the United States, where it quickly took root along the Charles River near Boston. The Charles had been an important avenue for boat transportation before and after European contact, and it was dammed for industrial purposes from the beginning of the 1700s. In 1812, a huge dam was built across the Charles at Moody Street in Waltham that dwarfed all the previous efforts. As a Metropolitan Parks Commission report would later explain, "It was not until after the river had ceased to be useful as a highway for the conveyance of merchandise and lumber that dams were built in the main stream itself. These dams were originally constructed in accordance with the terms of an act of the General Court, by which it was sought to encourage manufacturing. With this purpose in view, the Commonwealth practically made a present to the manufacturers of as much common property in the rivers and lakes of the state as they required for establishing of manufacturing by water power. The dam was a boon to the growing number of recreational canoeists a few decades later, who paddled along the section of river that was known as the Lakes District. It formed a 6-mile-long lake that reached from Moody Street in Waltham, upstream through Weston and Newton, almost to Newton Lower Falls. There were many bends, coves, and islands along miles of lakeshore. In the late 19th century, public transportation began to open up the suburbs for recreation, as historic Newton points out. By the end of the century, the streetcars were electrified, and the scale of streetcar transportation became not just local, but metropolitan. Streetcar franchises enjoyed a financial boom. New projects flourished, and in 1895, the Commonwealth Avenue Street Railway extended its service over tracks in the median of the new boulevard, through Newton, to Walnut Street, and the next year to Auburndale. At the same time, changing patterns of work led to the rise of the weekend, so people had more free time to spend exploring the countryside. Some of them were spending that time on dates. Prior to this time, courtship mainly consisted of a young gentleman calling on a young lady in her home at her invitation. During this period, courtship patterns shifted and gave rise to the modern concept of a date, in which a man and a woman would engage in an activity together outside the home and unchaperoned. As Boston grew rapidly and the suburbs urbanized, the state began to buy land for parks along the Charles River. In 1893, a new agency was formed to buy and protect open space, known as the Metropolitan Parks Commission. Within a few years, they controlled vast tracts of land in and around Boston, from the Middlesex Fells to the Blue Hills. In a report about Boston parks prepared for the 1900 Paris Exposition, the commission outlines how it's protecting the banks of the Charles. Along the Charles River, takings were recommended from Boston to Newton Lower Falls, including territory upon both banks, forming nearly a continuous ribbon. Acquisitions have been made which include all those recommendations, and which have reserved sufficient additional territory to extend the realm of public ownership nearly to Dedham. Over 560 acres are included in these lands, exclusive of banks restricted but not taken. Dating culture, the rise of the weekend, new suburban parks, and access to public transportation all collided at the end of the 19th century and turn of the 20th century to make the Lakes District along the Charles River one of the most popular weekend destinations. The canoe craze hit its peak right around the turn of the 20th century. A 1902 Metropolitan Parks Commission report said, "The use of the upper river for boating continues to increase. There are at least 3,000 canoes in regular use in this section of the river during the season." That quote in the 1903 tourist guide about crossing the river by stepping from one canoe to another wasn't that far from the truth. In the show notes this week, we'll have a link to a short film shot in 1904 by the Thomas Edison Company. Notice that I didn't say by Thomas Edison. He was good enough at taking credit for the achievements of others. We don't need to do that for him. The film's about 2 minutes long, and it shows the Charles River just choked with young people in scores of canoes. A souvenir pamphlet said, "Without doubt, no other sport in New England has made the wonderful advances that have been made in canoeing, and nowhere in the world is the canoeing interest so great as on our own Charles River. Here 10 years ago were to be found comparatively few canoes. Now, within a distance of 4 miles, there are nearly 5,000, while above the falls, in the clubs and houses extending far above South Natick, may be found thousands more." These thousands of canoes led to a cottage industry along the river. There were factories that made canoes, and there were workshops where you could learn to build your own. There were dance halls and amusements, but above all, there were boathouses, many of which were advertised in that very same pamphlet. Clustered around the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge over the river in Newton's Auburndale, boathouses lined both banks of the river. They were mostly graceful structures, long and narrow, with the fronts facing the street and the rear opening up directly onto docks on the river. Many offered canoes for rent by the hour or by the day, which was perfect for the urbanite arriving by trolley for a day on the water with his sweetheart. Some offered long-term storage for rent, so after you built or bought your own canoe, you could keep it in a boathouse and take it out on the river anytime. By the mid-1880s, a guidebook would gush, "At Riverside are the clubhouses of the Newton Boat Club and the Boston Canoe Club, with the Partelow and Robertson boathouses, where visitors may hire yachts, canoes, wherries, lapstrakes, randans, Whitehall boats, steam launches, and other craft." One of the large boathouses at Riverside was operated by the Boston Athletic Association. Today, the BAA is most widely known as the organizer of the Boston Marathon, but they have a long history of promoting sports and fitness activities of all kinds. Their boathouse in Weston was a perfect example of this, allowing BAA members access to the health benefits of paddling. They had a 20-acre compound, with football fields, baseball diamonds, tennis courts, and, of course, a track. For $2 a year, members could berth a canoe at the BAA boathouse. Right next door, an entrepreneur started the Riverside Recreation Grounds, a 40-acre complex of sports fields, tennis courts, and swimming pools. It was all tied together with yet another boathouse. While developments on the western side of the river focused on wholesome athletics, the Newton Shore hosted Norumbega Park, which had a much more carnal atmosphere. Named after an ancient Viking settlement that an eccentric local businessman imagined along the river, Norumbega Park advertised itself as Boston's famous pleasure resort. In 1897, the Commonwealth Avenue Street Railway Company opened the park to try to tempt more riders into taking their trolleys all the way to the end of the line, and admission was included in your trolley fare. In the early years, Norumbega could boast New England's largest zoo and theater, and it had a carousel, a penny arcade, and of course the requisite boathouse, where visitors could rent a canoe for the day. Famous chefs prepared lavish meals in the park's restaurants, while vaudeville acts provided entertainment in the theater. Over the years, it added more attractions, like a Ferris wheel, bumper cars, and a large ballroom where big bands would perform for a nationally syndicated radio show. With hordes of city people descending on leafy Weston and Newton every weekend, it's little wonder that the Metropolitan Parks Commission police wanted to keep order. They constructed their own boathouse right next door to Norumbega Park, a beautiful stone and timber structure that still stands today, right next to the Comav Bridge over the river. They had a watchtower and a motorized launch that were mostly used for life-saving, at least at first. In 1902, the agency reported, "The river has been patrolled in boats as before. 80 cases of upsets from boats have been reported. 36 of these were actual rescues from the water by the police. The others have been brought into the office or have come in themselves for assistance after getting ashore. Last winter, a young woman was drowned at Waltham while skating. One drowning accident also occurred during the summer from the upsetting of a canoe. The three other occupants of the canoe were rescued by the officer on patrol." That mission changed the very next year. As historian Thomas McMullen put it, "In 1903, the Park Commission and its police force, in part citing safety concerns, embarked on a program to change the behavior of young canoeists on the river. In August, at the height of the canoeing season, the MPC announced new rules of conduct for boaters. The most significant was Rule Number 1, which forbade activities such as drinking, gambling, and most important, any obscene or indecent act. The MPC interpreted this final prohibition to mean that couples could no longer lie down in canoes, nor could they kiss. Young people had flocked to the Charles in no small part because of the privacy and intimacy they could find in a canoe on the river. In an era before cars provided suitors with a private space on wheels, and when prying eyes were everywhere in the city, an afternoon alone on the Charles must have seemed like heaven." Canoe historian Roger Young said, "To go canoeing on the weekend was pretty much what you did with your best girl. There weren't a whole lot of motor cars around at that time. You could go bicycling, but to go out canoeing was the thing." And author Hunter Oatman Stanford notes that adolescents took to the waters with the urgency of salmon fighting their way upstream. As early as 1889, authors recognized this element of the Lakes District's appeal. "Here, the river is narrow and still, flowing between high grassy banks embroidered with sweetbriar and daisies, and among cool and shadowy thickets and groves, where the young people in their pretty boats enjoy the charms of solitude à deux." Above Riverside, there is a little more of wildness, with here and there a fallen trunk, over which luxuriant vegetation has scrambled, jutting into the stream, and making incomparable nooks of shade, in which our boating parties seem to have a strong and perfectly natural propensity for mooring. When the MPC police began enforcing the new rules on August 15, 1903, there was public outcry and a sense of ridicule from around the country. As the first arrests were announced, national wire services picked up the story. A Reading, Pennsylvania paper ran this story on August 19th. Young couple arrested for violating rule of Boston's Park Commission. Lovemaking has been prohibited on the Charles River by the Metropolitan Park Commission. And hereafter, the fellow who takes his best girl on a canoeing trip must keep a watchful eye out for the police. About 4,000 canoe owners between Waltham and Dedham are interested. One couple has been arrested. They are Miss Flora Smith of New York and Matthew A. Peterson of Dorchester. They were arrested near the Weston Bridge late Saturday afternoon. Superintendent Haberly of the Charles River Reservation and Patrolman Coombs of the Metropolitan Police Force were looking for violations of the law when they saw the young man and the girl kissing in a canoe. This, they maintain, is a violation of Rule Number 1 of the Park Commission, which says that no improper actions shall be carried on. Peterson's lawyer says that perhaps he did kiss the young woman, and if he did, it is no crime. Canoe owners are indignant about the new rule, and petitions are being circulated, which will eventually reach Governor Bates. Superintendent Haberly says that all he desires is to keep the disorderly element from the river. MacMullen again describes how the canoe kids united in acts of protest against the new rules. The response to the arrest was swift and sure. Signing a petition addressed to the owners of area boathouses, over 350 canoeists threatened to remove their canoes if the owners didn't pressure the Park Commission to change its policy. The number of canoeists on the river dropped precipitously, particularly among young women. Those canoeists who did venture onto the Charles refused to sit up straight. The Boston Daily Globe reported that young women seemed particularly bold in taunting the plainclothes police to take action against them. Canoeists massed at the Park Police Station and hurled taunts at those inside. On the weekend of August 21st to 23rd, more significant protests were mounted. On Friday night, all up and down the river, couples continued to lie down in their canoes and singled other canoeists with the call, "Cheese it! Here's the cop!" Joining in the protest, young boys shot beans at the police boats from a railroad bridge. On Saturday night, a band concert was held at one of the boathouses. Scores of couples attended, defiantly lying under blankets in their canoes. When the police launch approached the area, it was met with jeers, hisses, and pounding on the canoes. The band struck up the tune, "Please Go Away and Let Me Sleep." The next day, the protesters took more direct action. Canoeists, both men and women, massed below Superintendent Haberly's office, which overlooked the river. They sprawled out in disregard of the MPC rules and set up phonographs outside the superintendent's office, playing, as the Post put it, jesting songs into his ear. Up and down the river, canoeing couples baited the police, playing love songs, throwing kisses at the officers, and disobeying the sit-up rule. It may sound like a 60s love-in, but keep in mind that this all happened in 1903. The park commissioners were unmoved, telling the press, "It's not a very nice spectacle to see a couple of opposite sexes lying in the bottom of a boat with a blanket thrown over them." Local ministers and newspapers blamed wild young men from the city, who would bring their unsuspecting dates out to the suburbs to get them liquored up and take advantage of them. However, only about a third of the people arrested under the anti-kissing rules were from Boston. The rest were from the supposedly upstanding suburbs along the river, such as Wellesley, Dover, Newton, and Waltham. Meanwhile, the press continued to have a field day. Of the $20 fine, the Herald said, "At that rate, it is estimated that over $1 million worth of kisses are exchanged at that popular canoeing resort every fine Saturday night and Sunday." The Boston Sunday Journal published a front-page editorial cartoon captioned, "Park Commission Drives Cupid from the Charles." Within a month, the boathouses along the river in Newton and Weston announced that their business had fallen by 50% or more. The young people of Boston had found an easy way to defeat the puritanical prudishness of the Metropolitan Parks Commission. Move their canoodling to Dedham. Dedham's just a few miles upriver from Newton, and it also boasts miles of languid riverbanks, with plenty of shadowy thickets and groves. The Dedham Boat Club was an easy 5-minute walk from Dedham Station. Best of all, the Metropolitan Parks Commission police had no jurisdiction along the Charles and Dedham, as the banks were not parkland. 2 years later, a large ballroom called Mosley's on the Charles opened up in Dedham, and more boathouses would follow. Soon, the Riverdale section of Dedham was the center of gravity for Boston's canoe craze. There were canoe liveries, carousels, and a steam-powered organ called a calliope. Hundreds of people would gather on the banks to watch races between local canoe clubs. In the meantime, boathouse owners at Riverside and Newton complained that the MPC had killed the sport of canoeing. In the end, the automobile killed the pastime of canoeing, at least as it was known at the turn of the last century. If young people flocked to canoes in order to enjoy some privacy and intimacy, imagine how they felt about the Ford Model T, which was basically a bedroom on wheels. By World War I, young couples who might previously have kissed in a canoe were searching out secluded lovers' lanes. During the Depression, many boathouses went out of business, as thrifty canoe owners began storing their crafts at home, or sold them outright. In March of 1936, intense rains caused floods across most of New England, and the Charles River wasn't spared. Many of the remaining boathouses were swept away, and nobody cared to replace them. Riverside Recreation Center closed in 1958, and Norumbega Park closed in 1963. A series of suspicious fires destroyed the boathouses, dance halls, and restaurants in the Riverside area between 1959 and 1965. Today, a Marriott stands on the site of the amusement park at Norumbega. By the mid-1960s, there was a growing public awareness of the sad state of the Charles River. Untreated sewage and waste from 2 centuries of industrial use flowed through the river, which earned the bad reputation it got from the Standells' song, Dirty Water. After a half-century of efforts by citizen groups like the Charles River Watershed Association, the Charles has now rebounded enough to enjoy something of a second canoe and kayak craze in recent decades. Things have improved to the point that the Charles River Conservancy is planning a public swimming park for the Charles River Basin, an area that was once one of the most polluted waterways in the nation. When you think of the Charles River today, you probably picture the Charles River Basin, those few miles between Watertown Square and the old Charles River Dam at the Museum of Science. When the state was considering whether to build that dam, there seemed to be very little chance that it would ever be used for pleasure craft. Here's what the commission had to say. The only noteworthy employment of the lower Charles for boating is for shells, and those who row in these have little cause for complaint. 15 inches depth of water is considered sufficient in the rowing tanks of Harvard, and 2 feet in the river should be ample for rowing of all kinds. Of course, these days, on any warm afternoon, you'll see the small sailboats of community boating tacking back and forth across the river. The rowing shells that plied the river a century ago are still there, and they're accompanied today by a few canoes and a whole lot of kayaks. However, if your only frame of reference is the basin, you need to get out and explore upriver. The lakes region we talked about today is still accessible by bus and commuter rail, and if you have a car, there are dozens of places to launch a canoe or kayak along about 40 miles of river upstream from the basin. You can still see a couple of relics from the last canoe craze. Mosley's on the Charles is still a ballroom and event hall in Dedham, and the old MPC Police Department boathouse still stands on the banks of the river in Newton. Ironically, the headquarters of the crackdown on kissing and canoes is now a canoe and kayak rental business. If you want to learn all the places to rent a kayak along the river, or launch your own, check out my other website, charlesriverguide.com. To learn more about kissing and canoes on the Charles, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/041. We'll have a collection of pictures from the Charles River canoe craze, maps showing how trolley lines gave urbanites access to the river, and even the 1904 Thomas Edison film of Canoes on the Charles. We'll have links to some great articles about this era, and we'll have a link to my interactive guide to the Charles River. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. That's still the best way to help others discover the show. That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about Boston and the total eclipse of 1806. Just to let you guys in on a secret, Nikki and I did record this episode together, but we had a slight problem with the audio, and it came out sounding, well, it sounded a little bit like this. Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 41, the history of canoes and canoodling on the Charles River. Hi, I'm Jake.